Welcome everyone to another Ecosystemic Futures podcast. We are working with the world's elite thought leaders who are leading meaningful development in areas that could impact society in the next half century, provided by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with SocialWorks, the global firm advising organizations on ecosystemic transformation. I'm joined today by Vikram Shyam, lead futurist at Glenn Research Center. Vikram, welcome.
Hey everyone, I'm Vic. I've been at NASA for over 15 years. I'm currently the futurist for the Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project, or CAS. And our team uses strategic foresight with approximately a 25 to 50 year horizon. And we're looking to explore societal problems. Some people call them wicked problems. So we're looking at where is it that we as NASA, as well as the aeronautics community, can have the broadest possible impact on as many people as possible in terms of improving society's well-being and resilience for the future.
I'm thrilled to have you here with us today, and equally thrilled to welcome our guest, Laura Thomas. Laura is a former CIA case officer and chief of base who led sensitive CIA programs at the CIA headquarters and abroad in multiple international assignments. She served 18 years in various national security leadership roles, working across the IC, National Security Council, and various national security and leadership roles, working with the U.S. Congress, U.S. Department of States, U.S. Department of Defense, and with foreign partners. Laura is currently advising a quantum technology company, Inflection, and a fusion energy company, Fuse. Laura, welcome. We're thrilled to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Laura, why don't we start off with a little bit of your background? You have just such a fascinating journey and portfolio of work. Would love to really start there and then just dive into this as we go.
Okay. Well, I think, Vic, you put it well when you said solving wicked problems. I love solving wicked hard problems with wicked smart people. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to do that the past few years as an advisor to two deep tech companies. As you mentioned, one, Inflection Quantum Technology, fusing quantum sensors and quantum computers, and then also Fusion Technology Company that's also working on radiation hardening and nuclear effects, Fuse. Before that, yes, I was at the CIA. I was a case officer there. I ran a number of overseas programs. Basically, my job was to go out and recruit foreigners to provide sensitive information and handle them. And a lot of that was dealing with a lot of information or sometimes too little information and having to make decisions with information overload or a lack of knowing and amid a lot of ambiguity and uncertainty. And I think that translates incredibly well to startup life because that's what startups live and breathe every day. Lots of uncertainty, ambiguity, not really fully understanding markets yet, having early and nascent technologies, especially when you think about deep tech. So it was a fairly natural jump, I think. I guess people, it's debatable. I thought it was a pretty natural jump. And I feel like I've certainly been able to help companies take what it is they're building, translate it to a policymaker audience, certain government audiences, certainly letting the technical people do their thing on the technical side. I take it and I say, okay, what does this actually mean? And what is it that we need to do in order to really push these sorts of technologies out into the world?
Well, you've chosen to, in your current portfolio, it seems that to focus on the deep tech that has even greater importance from a national security or national safety and resilience perspective. Did your background perhaps inform the paths of advisory work that you're doing in that respect? Are you drawn to those deep technologies that have greater strategic impact?
Potential, yeah. I mean, I look, if it's not national security related, I'm probably not going to be involved in it. I like to say when I jumped from CIA, it was not a change in mission. It was just a change in path. So when you look at any of these major technologies, though, I can't think of one that you could name that I would say that is not of some sort of national security importance, because any technology that has the potential of transforming society, changing the way we think and do business and operate in the world, anything that is a platform shift is going to have some sort of national security, international security implications. And we can't forget that today, economic security is national security as well. Economic prosperity and national security, you can't really disentangle those two things anymore.
So true. So true. And that's a battle that we're fighting right now. I mean, the economic state of the nation, but also globally, has been a little bit of a bumpy ride for the past few years. And I'm still confident that entrepreneurship will be one thread of resilience that will, again, begin to fuel that economic recovery. The entrepreneurs that are working in deep tech today are just incredible. Brilliant deep tech, brilliant use cases, and with the potential to inform the way society and industry really grow over the next several decades. And I know, Vic, that's something that you and the team are working on. You're focused on the wicked problems over the next, shaping the industry and society over the next several decades. What are some of the parallels that you see in your team's portfolio of work with the focus areas that Laura is working on?
So I think some of the interesting questions here around, Laura spoke a little bit about the quantum infusion. And one of the biggest things coming up is sustainable energy for the future, and especially around infrastructure for people to move around, for people and cargo. So I guess one of the things I'm interested in is understanding Laura's perspective on what exactly is the outlook for fusion? What are the biggest challenges? Are they actually technology challenges, or are they more policy and economics? And how is it you explain that, let's say, to the people that you're working with or to the government? And the other side of it is there's a trade-off between privacy and trying to get things done by sharing and being more collaborative. And a lot of this, when you're looking at healthcare and you're looking at providing people services more rapidly and integrating networks, so for example, having aviation or other transportation modes being part of the solution for healthcare, whether it's drone delivery or it's trying to monitor populations to see where is it that a response is needed more quickly, out or out people. So this starts to infringe on people's personal data, people's privacy. So how do you make that trade-off? How do you explain that again? And how is the government prepared policy-wise, and what needs to be done?
So, yeah, I think all great points. I think anyone who can give you a firm and concise answer on your last question about trade-offs and how to really crack that nut, that they're probably not telling the truth, because it is such a complicated problem. There is no silver bullet answer, but that's why good governance matters. And that's certainly, I agree, Diane, entrepreneurs are doing wonderful things, and they've built so many of the technologies that are really driving the U.S. economy forward today. But a lot of those sort of early things that were done, semiconductors, the internet, I mean, that was all done on the back of the government. And the government also plays a really important role in regulation, and we do need some of that. And a lot of entrepreneurs, they don't want to talk about that. They don't want to say that, because everyone is so fearful of overreach, because it happens all the time. It slows down the industry, and many times cutting off the industry at its knees, in some cases before it can even get up and run. So it is a big problem. But that's why we have to have just a very robust and healthy dialogue with startups, with big tech, though we should always keep in mind the incentives and the ability for big tech to lobby in a way that small startups can't. But then the government agencies as well. And I think what we really could stand to benefit from is a revolving door between government agencies and the private sector. And I don't mean a revolving door like a general retires and goes and takes a big senior position at Northrop Grumman. But, and I'm not saying that's the worst thing ever, but what I'm saying is people at the mid-levels being able to rotate out and go work at one of these fast-paced startups, see what it's like, understand the challenges. And then vice versa, having folks that are startups going into government service and understanding what are the challenges on that side. And I think that would really help us as we think through these really wicked, hard problems of how do you think about privacy and security in a space where technology is just moving so fast, it's very hard for us to keep up from a regulatory standpoint.
That's a really great point. We've seen some experiments, too prevalent, but a few experiments of almost reverse mentoring, to your point. So mid-level, early career government employees that are taking an assignment in the entrepreneurial space, right? Just to get a really good immersion in that landscape, the challenges and where there might be arenas for kind of more streamlined pathways of communication, collaboration, funding, execution. I do think that would be helpful. And then vice versa, right? To your point, how can we create better visibility between the two sides of that coin so that we get more cohesion, more friction-free pathways for business and critical technologies to scale up more quickly? Because to your point, a lot of these emerging technologies capabilities are kind of mission critical for the nation, and the government is necessarily customer number one or is funding. So how can you get a better balance given the pace and the amplitude of change in these innovation markets? Are you seeing some best practices out there?
Yeah, I mean, Department of Defense, they have a program that does this. There are other agencies that are starting sort of pilot programs. Look, it's always going to be an ethics issue, and you're going to have government lawyers usually that are like, oh, we can't do this because, there's contracts and ethics, and we can work through the ethics. It's not illegal. Yeah. There are regulations. There's a difference between a law and an agency regulation, and knowing where you stand in between them and making sure you're on the bright, solid line of not violating ethics is important. We can do that. We just need to do it, and it's going to take senior leadership with the wherewithal to know that it's needed and implement it all the way down through the mid levels, the frozen middle of bureaucracy, which I worked in for quite some time. That has to happen. I will say on the startup side, especially in deep tech national security, people are hungry and they will take you up on these offers. They will take any person that you send and they will plug them in and they will give them an incredible experience, and it'll stay away from contracting issues and ethics. I can at least promise you that from the companies that I work with.
Some, if we could just real quickly double click on those companies that you work with in the basically the deep tech arenas that they're working within. If you could, just for our audience who may or may not be as familiar with these spaces, maybe break down fusion and quantum, just kind of a layman's.
Fusion is essentially the what powers the stars. If we were to be able to commercialize fusion, we would essentially have limitless, clean, abundant energy. It would solve a lot of problems. It wouldn't solve every problem. And I'm not saying that we should just sit on our, rest on our laurels and wait until fusion is ready before we do some real things to address the climate crisis we have. But it is one of these technologies that will be a complete game changer. I mean, it's a $40 trillion market. And when you start measuring markets in the trillions, who even knows at that point? I mean, that's sort of the numbers that McKinsey's of the world out there put on it. It's real. It's the technology has been proven. National Ignition Facility has actually proven that fusion can work for energy, but figuring out how to commercialize it and make it affordable and repeatable and scalable, that is a challenge. And that is very hard. And I do not want to trivialize that at all. I think you're going to have a lot of capital put into this. Where I think it matters is when you think about some of the companies working on fusion, are they actually building business muscle in what they're doing on a day-to-day basis? Or are they essentially replicating experiments in the science that's done at a national lab? There's certainly an argument for that. More science is great. We need basic science too. But I would say if you're looking at fusion companies, really ones that are finding ways to generate revenue now, learning how to be a business, learning how to work with customers, those are the ones that are probably going to be more successful over the long term. And for example, the company that I'm working with, the way they're looking at fusion is certainly the North Star of the company. But before that, there's radiation effects and nuclear effects testing that you can do that generates money. This is a huge issue, big demand, unmet demand within the U.S. government, Department of Energy, Department of Defense. Basically, you take a burst of energy and you shoot it at an object, you bombard it with X-rays, gamma rays, neutrons, and you see how it reacts. And based on how an object reacts, you can design better materials, better objects to perform in outer space or to build better infrastructure that can withstand cosmic rays when you start thinking about space travel, but also worst case scenario, if there were to be a nuclear bomb blast, how will our infrastructure survive at certain distances? So that's fusion. On the quantum side, a lot of people think, oh, quantum is one of these science fiction things. It's something that I saw on my latest Netflix binge watching. No, it's here. It's actually real. It exists today. Quantum computers exist today. They're just not powerful enough to do and solve real world problems. But we are seeing trend lines where the rate of achievement after achievement in the quantum computing space is just growing and compounding. And quantum is one of those things that when you have the ability to do certain computations that are just not available to us right now, it will also be one of these platform shift technologies. You think about, and these are smaller problems, but they actually matter a lot. When you think about airports and you think about logistics, think about Amazon, thousands of trucks, thousands of packages, millions of packages every day that they have to ship, all the gas that's used in those aircraft, trucks, or just civilian airliners. When you can use a quantum computer, you can compute better optimization. How do you optimize routes that are better for the environment, that save the customer money, that save the company money, and also a real boon to humanity because we're not guzzling as much gas? I mean, those are some of the earlier, or at least more palpable problems that quantum can solve. But also there's quantum chemistry, essentially designing new materials. If you could imagine building an aircraft that is not built from what we traditionally build aircraft today, that would be way more fuel efficient. You know, that's the promise of quantum. Also vaccine development. If you can imagine building a COVID vaccine, doing all the research that's needed, but compressing timeframes down into a matter of weeks rather than, well, in the COVID case, a year, but that was also on the back of a lot of mRNA technology. So vaccines, I can't remember the number, but it's like 13 years or something ridiculous to get to a vaccine. Yeah. So that is quantum in a nutshell and sort of the applications that it can do. That's on the compute side. What a lot of people don't know is there's much more to quantum than quantum computing. There's quantum sensors as well. And these are basically sensors that are 1,000 times more sensitive and give you more accurate data. And from a national security perspective, especially, that really matters. But from a commercial or benefit to humanity perspective, if you can imagine sensors monitoring the North Pole, looking at the polar ice caps, how they're melting, if you can measure something so precise that it's not over a matter of days, weeks, years, but, you know, very small timeframes, you can start to design better technology to potentially combat that, or at least to understand the threat in a more palpable way. Mm-hmm. So I'll stop there because that's a lot.
No, makes sense. I'm wondering, so you mentioned quantum and fusion. You explained it in ways that are easy to understand, which I appreciate. But the thing is, there's so many different technologies. And often we talk about, I'd use this term of the great disconnect in terms of the number of technologies that are being developed is proliferating very rapidly. And when you talk about the ability to regulate or to form policy around it to help the startup. Yes, we'd set up systems that are maybe cumbersome at times, but there were fewer technologies back several decades ago, and you could focus around them. You had these measures around understanding their impact on society, all of that stuff. It's harder to do as the number of technologies grow. And you mentioned before we started recording, we were talking about, I think you mentioned the peanut butter analogy where things are spread pretty thin. So how is it possible for, let's say, the government or regulatory bodies to actually understand what regulations need to be in place versus stifling innovation? How do you get that when you have this peanut butter type funding?
Yeah. Investment? Yeah. And I'll go back and I'll give a little bit of context of what I mean by peanut butter being spread thin. When we think about some of the awards that are put out there by NASA or any government agency, generally, from a startup perspective, what we find is you'll see awards that are spread very thin over multiple companies. They also try to usually involve an academic institution. And there is a reason for that. It's politically beneficial. It's, you know, everyone feels like they want a trophy and everyone's happy. It's a great press release. We feel like, great, we're all going to collaborate. Well, that's where technology dies, just to be really blunt. It's not that it won't survive and that there's no case where it's worked, but generally, the more people you try to put together and the less money you give them, you're just complicating an actual solution coming out the other end. Now, I am not arguing for the opposite, that we should completely focus all money on just one company and we don't want to go to that extreme either. That's my comment on the funding environment. Back to the regulatory piece. Yeah, I think it's a matter of just getting out and policymakers, agency folks, talking to the companies that are actually building these technologies and understanding what their hurdles are and what will sort of knock them and cut them off the knees before they can really start running.
You mentioned something about a lot of this is about how quickly we can act and how to save, let's say, time and money. And I'm wondering, what's the relevance to, let's say, someone who was an average person that has multiple jobs and such. When we talk about societal or wicked problems, why focus on accelerating these technologies when, and very often we're talking about these global threats, we're talking about competitors, non-US competitors, I'm not going to mention specifically, you had to mention some names before, but should we perhaps focus on things like poverty and inequity, things like that, and then talk about what can help, what technologies might help with that versus the technology up? Or are they one and the same? How do you view it?
Yeah, I think the answer to that largely depends on, do you view technology as a force for good? And I do. Do I think that it sometimes can be a double-edged sword? Absolutely. Are there things we need to be thinking very deeply and thoughtfully about? Absolutely. But generally, I think it's a force for good. I guess you could say I'm a techno-optimist. And if you look back at some of the technologies that have really transformed the world, they've also pulled people out of poverty. We have so much more free time than what we used to have. And I know that can ring very hollow if you're talking to a working mom, single working mom, who's working two or maybe three jobs to survive. At the end of the day, I still believe that technology is one of the ways that we pull ourselves out of that. That does not mean that we only in the U.S. government just do technology. Again, this goes back to good governance. There are a lot of other programs and a lot of other work that lawmakers have to focus on. Technology is one of them. And I would argue technology is one we absolutely have to get right because our adversaries are out there. And whether or not we feel like we are at war, they are at war with us in many ways. And it's an economic war. It's a cyber war. And in my mind, that's just the reality. And we can't afford to fall behind.
It's a war for global influence and really kind of positioning too. And I agree with you, Laura. I think depending on where you focus the conversation or where you jump into the conversation, yes, there's a lot of discussion about technology acceleration, capability acceleration. Hopefully, to your point, I'm also an optimist in this respect. Those are a means to an end, right? The acceleration of technologies should be focused on exceptional outcomes, beneficial outcomes, beneficial experiences, lifting more out of poverty, addressing some of those wicked problems. So if you're jumping into the conversation and the investor community, we're talking about investments, we're talking about technology acceleration, the platform shifts. If we're talking to the entrepreneurs, we're tapping into their vision for those outcomes that their technologies can unlock for humanity, for industry. And we're really, I think, benefiting from, to your point, some of these platform shift technologies can really open up just a wealth of opportunities for really wicked problem resolution and beneficial outcomes for society. But we've been talking, the optimists that we are, we've been talking about some of the incredible benefits of these technologies. Laura, you're also on the front line of assessing the risk, and you're probably uniquely qualified to assess the risk of both the entrepreneurial journey in some of these spaces, but also some of the potential risks that the technologies represent for industry, for society. What are some of those risks that kind of keep you up at night in those arenas, and how are you guys addressing them?
If we were to be able to build a quantum computer that can break all encryption, which is a potential, it will take probably a million qubits. So just so everyone knows, we're pretty far away from that. But I mean, think of all your healthcare records, banking records. These are things that could be eventually accessed. Now, would it be as simple as pushing a button? No. But still, it would be something that a nation state could do, could pass on those capabilities, leak it. I mean, this would create utter chaos. It could bring down the financial system. I mean, these are things we absolutely need to be thinking about right now. And when you think about quantum, that's an argument for post-quantum cryptography, a way to protect our networks against quantum computers of the future. potentially quantum key distribution. There are other ways to sort of mitigate and combat the threat, but we shouldn't just go starry-eyed into the future as a, I'm just a techno-optimist to the point that I think there's zero downside. That's just foolish.
Yeah, great points. Great points. Mm-hmm. If, to that point, so we're seeing a shift. Oh, Vic, were you going to jump in here?
I was going to switch lanes a bit to this, to sustainability, perhaps. But did you have a related thought?
Yeah, just I'm listening to you and thinking about just really the incredible shift that we're seeing and that the new capabilities are introducing to the potential landscape, not only for industry and society, but also for career pathing, right? So now students, tomorrow's leaders, tomorrow's workforce have the opportunity to plug into kind of educational pathways to begin to position themselves well against this really incredible landscape of new opportunities. But if you are in the field today and drawn to kind of these types of opportunities, what does this mean for talent today? And we're seeing the entrepreneurs obviously invest in this arena, but if folks that are in their careers today and drawn to these new horizons, are you seeing pathways for folks to begin to move into these new sectors, these new technologies? What's the story for talent?
Deep tech is very hard to recruit talent for.
I used to
say in the quantum industry, like we just don't have the number of physicists. Now, we also don't have a number of business people too, because it takes more than physicists. It takes technicians, takes people to build it, to get out there and really talk about it. But the core sort of physics-based and engineering backgrounds that we need, we don't have enough of in the US. These are things that companies have to think about. How do we go and recruit folks that have exceptional backgrounds, make sure that we're bringing them to the US, that they are the person who really wants to be in the US and build for the US, stay in the US? That's hard. And that's going to take a lot of other sort of patchwork when you think about Department of State and the way we do visas. And this is one of those collective action problems. If you're in one of these sort of areas, though, physics, engineering on fusion or quantum, oh, there are a lot of companies lined up that just can't wait to see your resume. Even better if you've gone into the government and you have a security clearance, because that says a lot. Doesn't say everything. There's been some people with security clearance who also have done some really dumb things. But generally, if you've passed through those checks and you can work on future government programs, you're going to be a hot commodity.
Yeah, I wanted to switch to talking about sustainability a bit. So when we're talking about some of these new technologies like AI and cryptocurrencies and quantum fusion, very often there's a huge energy demand, especially in quantum. When you talk about thermal management, you talk about the resource extraction, the types of materials that are required for quantum technologies. Is there a concern from a climate change perspective that perhaps we're doing more harm than good? How do you manage that trade-off?
No, I can see where people would ask that question. And I'm not. It is a legitimate question. But at least when I look at my company and Inflection, our quantum computer is essentially the equivalent of a few hair dryers as far as energy consumption. Now, when you think about scaling some of the other types of modalities of quantum computers, yeah, it will be a big energy suck. But yeah, ultimately, I think you have to look to what do you gain in the end? And the net gain is so much greater when these technologies could help us essentially create new materials that would not solve the climate crisis, but greatly reduce and address it in ways that I think are just so much more beneficial than the risk that we're taking in some sustainability issues around developing the technologies in their current state.
Do you see, I guess this is a very hypothetical question. So when do you see fusion actually maturing? So do you think, let's say we talk about airports 50 years from now, do you see the infrastructure and aircraft that are being powered by fusion?
Yeah, well, maybe we'll have fusion drives propelling NASA folks through outer space. Years, I can't say. I know that at Fuse, we are looking at a 10-year timeline. That's very ambitious. These are hard problems, but we're working day in and day out to try and solve it. And we're not doing it alone. And the reason why I love doing government-related podcasts, because there's so much that we're doing with the government and leveraging the government and then both benefiting each other in a public-private partnership model to really realize these technologies. I think that is absolutely critical. And to realize them in a time frame that's not always 20 years away, even more so.
Yeah, and to that point, Laura, I know we're coming up on our time, and this has just been brilliant. To that point, there's just an incredible collaboration and partnership between the public and private sector that is not only shaping a conversation around what the future looks like, but also what capabilities and technologies and models could really benefit society for the next several decades. And I just love to see kind of watch this conversation take form in the form of the investments that are being activated and the entrepreneurship, and then how that begins to shape into a kind of a collaboration with big industry and mature industries as well. Just the emergence and the convergence of these new capabilities is just really exciting in terms of what it means for society. And I think the role that NASA is playing and the work, Vic, that you and the team and the broader NASA community are leading is just really exciting in this space. And Laura, if you were to kind of distill this, tough to do, but if you were to distill this work and this conversation and this opportunity into a few key takeaways for our listeners, what suggestions would you have? And two, if the listeners are interested in learning a little bit more about these areas, if you have any recommendations for resources for them too, that would be super helpful.
Yeah, takeaways, keep building, keep grinding, don't stop. We need you.
Run fast. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, you're going to fail sometimes. That's okay. Not always as okay in the government context, but find a way to fight through the bureaucracy at times. It can be done. And it has been done many times. And we've accomplished so many wonderful things through the government in this country doing that. So I'm thankful to all the folks still in the government working on these really hard problems. Resources. One on quantum would be the Futurum Group. They have some pretty good articles and really getting at it from a technical standpoint, sort of diagnosing the industry and where is it really versus what are the hyped headlines. Notboring.com is a good resource online. It's a guy, Patty McCormick. He writes about all sorts of emerging technologies and their impact. So I think that's a great resource. He really does dedicate a lot of time to digging deep and not just the superficial points of these technologies. So those would be two that I would start with. And that would also help folks understand, I think, too, from a startup perspective, some of the challenges that startups face in particular.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. On that point, I really appreciated your earlier point. It is no small feat to lead and scale a startup in these deep tech areas. So nothing but respect for those folks and hope they do keep at the fight, because this has the potential to reshape the way we live and interact for decades to come. So appreciate their work. Appreciate your work, Laura, and your time here today. Thank you for joining us and sharing your perspective. Thank you for the work that you're leading, and we look forward to following that great work. Certainly our community will plug into your digital exhaust and follow the great work that you're leading. And for folks that appreciated this conversation here today, please do follow us at Ecosystemic Futures Podcasts at shoshimworks.com. And thank you again, everyone, for joining us here today.
Thank you.